Law and Grace, Chapter 11. The land is mine. Israel is tenants of God's heritage, the covenant land. While they toiled as slaves in Egypt, the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage. Their agony did not go unheeded, for they were then, as now, beloved for the Father's sakes. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. In that covenant he had promised, "That nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance." The time had at last arrived for this pledge to take effect. God indicated this in his message to Moses at the bush. "I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians." This being so, Pharaoh was powerless to frustrate the divine purpose. Within a brief period, Israel had come out according to God's word. Unhappily, all too many of those who owed their deliverance to that word regarded the Exodus as an end in itself. Had they been right? Had God's purpose stopped short at their deliverance from bondage, the Exodus would still have been a historical prodigy, but it would nevertheless have been a meaningless and futile act. The protests made by the rebels would have been not only mutinous but also logical and unanswerable in the circumstances which gave rise to them. They asked Moses sarcastically, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness?" And concluded bitterly, "It had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness." God's answer to this came in the marvels of the crossing of the Red Sea. These should have silenced their murmurings once and for all. Yet, within a little time, they were complaining to Moses and Aaron once again. "You've brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." God's answer to this complaint was the provision of manna. But neither this nor any other miracle sufficed to preserve them from the same folly on subsequent occasions. The people's error was tragic, and this for two reasons. It witnessed to a lamentable lack of faith on their part, but this in turn betrayed an insultingly low estimation of the character of God himself. In speaking as they did, they were wantonly and contemptuously ignoring the terms of his covenant with Abraham. "In the fourth generation they shall come hither again. Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates." They acted as though no such pledge had been given. Yet, as they knew only too well, it had been repeated in God's assurance to Moses, which had already vindicated itself in their miraculous deliverance. "I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land unto a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey." They ought to have regarded that deliverance as but the essential preliminary to their settlement in the covenant land. That was how Moses regarded it. The Exodus was for him so certain a guarantee of the eventual entry into Canaan that he spoke of it as though it were already an accomplished fact. "Thou in thy mercy hast led forth the people which thou hast redeemed. Thou hast guided them in thy strength unto thy holy habitation." He accepted unreservedly the assurance given him by God after his first rebuff by Pharaoh. I will bring you into the land concerning the which I did swear to give it to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and I will give it to you for an heritage. I am the Lord. For him it was not only reassuring but also natural that the Book of the Covenant legislated for circumstances which in many cases could only arise in consequence of Israel's settlement in the land. He clearly regarded Sinai as merely a halt on the march from the land of bondage to the assured rest of the land of promise. As Israel approached the land which was to be their future home, it was both necessary and right that they should realize what manner of land it was. It was what Moses called it, God's holy habitation. And they had to realize that none but the holy could dwell in it. They were to understand clearly why the existing occupants of the land were to be dispossessed to make room for them. Not for thy righteousness or for the uprightness of thine heart dost thou go to possess their land, but for the wickedness of those nations the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee, and that he may perform the word which the Lord sware unto thy fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They would only bring down upon themselves the same dire judgment as would befall their predecessors if they should prove guilty of the same offences. It was the covenant which gave them the privilege of dwelling in the land, and the covenant alone. They were therefore to honour its moral demands. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and I will give you peace in the land. For I will have respect unto you and make you fruitful and multiply you and establish my covenant with you, and I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you, and I will walk among you, and will be your God, and ye shall be my people. If, on the other hand, they were traitors to the covenant, calamity would befall them. If you shall despise my statutes, so that ye break my covenant, I will bring a sword upon you that shall avenge the quarrel of my covenant. Their disobedience would reveal their hearts, in contrast to their bodies, to be uncircumcised. That is, betray a mood in them that was incompatible with the obligations of their covenant calling. God would consequently be compelled, in vindication of his own holiness, to visit judgment upon them. The land also shall be left of them, because they despised my judgments. The fact is already emerging that the camp and its arrangements were but an anticipation of the land as occupied by the covenant people. Camp and land were in fact parallel types. It is this which explains the use of identical language in connection with them both. We've already seen the soldiers' encampment to have been only a miniature version of the camp itself, and found what was true of the one to have been true also of the other. No place in the soldiers' encampment either for the unclean or for any form of human filth, and excrement had not only to be deposited outside it, but even them had also to be buried out of sight. For the Lord thy God walketh in the midst of thy camp, therefore shall thy camp be holy. In like manner, all who were lepers, who had issues and who were defiled by the dead, had to leave the camp, again in pursuance of the same moral end, that of teaching those who dwelt there to be holy. When we read God's promise regarding the land in the light of these facts, a parallel between it and the camp becomes patent. I will set my tabernacle among you, and I will walk among you, and will be your God, and ye shall be my people. The parallel could not be made plainer. The land, like the camp, was to be God's holy habitation. Life in the camp was an apprenticeship to life in the land. This meant, in practical terms, just that the land, like the camp, was no place for the morally unclean and corrupt, and that their presence there would not be tolerated by God. It was to be the abode of the holy, and the holy alone. The expulsion from the camp of those who were physically defiled was thus but a foreshadowing of the deportation of the nation from the land of its inheritance, if it should prove to be morally corrupt. All this was implicit in the Song of Moses. Looking forward to the occupation of Canaan, Moses sang, "Thou shalt bring them in and plant them in the mountain of thine inheritance, in the place, O Lord, which thou hast made for thee to dwell in, in the sanctuary, O Lord, which thy hands have established." The land as a whole would be God's abode, inasmuch as his tabernacle would be pitched within it. That is, the land would be to the eventual central shrine what the camp in the wilderness became to the sanctuary at its centre. Houses and farms would take the place of tents, and in due course the temple would supersede the tabernacle. But one thing would remain unchanged throughout the passage of time and alteration of circumstances: the principle on which God would consent to dwell among his people. That was unalterable. They had either to be holy like him or be banned from his presence. "Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, that the land spew not you out also when ye defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you." Paul saw to it that those who occupied the covenant land should be under no illusions from the very outset as to the moral obligations of their tenancy, or as to its conditional character. God had promised, "I will bring you in unto the land, and I will give it you for an heritage. I am the Lord." The terms of the promise were significant. "I will give it you." There was no question at all of the nations possessing a right to it. It was a gift. The law, in characteristic fashion, employed a variety of devices in order to bring this fact home to the people. The first of these devices was the method prescribed for the division of the land immediately it was invaded. Stood to reason that large tribes would need far more territory than much smaller ones. So, on the basis of equity, God decreed to Moses, "To many thou shalt give the more inheritance, and to the few thou shalt give the less inheritance." This was just and proper. The extent of the territory assigned to each tribe had clearly to be determined by its needs. "To everyone shall his inheritance be given according to those that were numbered of him." Yet there was to be no question of the powerful seizing the best for themselves, or of human conceptions of justice deciding the actual location of each tribe's inheritance, hence the rule. Notwithstanding, the land shall be divided by lot. According to the lot shall the possession thereof be divided between many and few. Each tribe had the right and duty to send a representative to supervise the drawing of the lots, but the actual allocation of the tribal areas was to be the prerogative of God alone. Only he, as owner of the land, had the right to decide precisely where each tribe should settle in it. For the same reason, the subdivision of the tribal inheritance had to be conducted according to the same principle. You shall divide the land by lot for an inheritance among your families. Once again, the actual amount of land allotted to each family was to be in strict proportion to the population to be supported by it. But the actual location of each family's estate within the tribe's inheritance was, like the location of that inheritance itself, to be decided by no one but God. Every man's inheritance shall be in the place where his lot falleth. It was in order to maintain this principle as a rule for posterity that a special law was promulgated forbidding daughters who were their father's sole heirs to marry men not of their own tribe. The children of Israel may enjoy every man the inheritance of his fathers, neither shall the inheritance remove from one tribe to another tribe. One tribe only received no special inheritance, Levi. This arrangement was made on God's express instructions. It was necessitated by the separation of the Levites to serve in the sanctuary in the nation's stead. Yet, representatively, let it be remembered, neither must the children of Israel henceforth come nigh the tabernacle of the congregation, lest they bear sin and die. But the Levites shall do the service of the tabernacle of the congregation, and they shall bear their iniquity. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations that among the children of Israel they have no inheritance. We have already established that the Levites, as ministers in the court, were an objective representation of the people as a whole. That factor is the clue to the moral purpose behind the arrangement which prevented them from having a tribal inheritance of their own. Obviously, the whole of the nation could not relinquish secular activities in favour of service at the sanctuary. Only by cultivating the soil could the mass of the nation survive. But what was impracticable for the nation as a whole was nevertheless feasible in the case of one tribe in particular. To Aaron, as head of this tribe, God said, "Thou shalt have no inheritance in their land, neither shalt thou have any part among them. I am thy part and thine inheritance among the children of Israel." The Levites, that is, were to depend entirely upon God for their sustenance. But since they were only typical of the nation as a whole, the principle involved was meant to hold good for all. The arrangement was meant to develop in the mind of every reflective Israelite a correct attitude toward his inheritance, judged as a material possession. The wealth and sustenance which it yielded him were never to blind him to the fact that those, like the soil itself, came to him from God. Though the words, "The Lord is his inheritance," applied strictly to Levi alone, each true Israelite nevertheless was meant to take the lesson to himself. Faithful indeed was the man who did so to such an extent that he could claim, "The Lord is the portion of mine inheritance and of my cup. Thou maintainest my lot. The lines are fallen unto me in pleasant places. Yea, I have a goodly heritage." Psalm 16. The method adopted by the law for teaching this most fundamental of spiritual lessons had, of course, to take certain practical factors into account. The Levites had, like others, to eat in order to live. They also needed homes in which to dwell. The law consequently made special arrangements to cater for their material needs, first in the tithing and related laws, and secondly in the allocation of special cities to the Levites. We shall find, as we now examine these, that though they were primarily practical in character, they were also designed to educate Israel in the things of God, and thus served a dual purpose, like so much else in the law. The Levites did the Israelites' work for them in the service of the sanctuary. So the rule was, "Behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance for the service which they serve." It is reasonable to suppose that this toll upon the resources and income of the people was an annual levy, but they had to attend the sanctuary to present it no more than once every 3 years. It was surrendered as a heave offering, that is, as something made over to God as his own. They were therefore not to begrudge the loss of it, but to see in the surrender of it a symbolic surrender of themselves to God. All the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's. It is holy unto the Lord. So also with a man's cattle. Concerning the tithe of the herd or of the flock, even of whatsoever passeth under the rod, the tenth shall be holy unto the Lord. To cater for problems of distance and transport, and no doubt also to some extent of preserving perishable produce, provision was made for the redemption of the tithe in the case of both field produce and animals. But to stress the absoluteness of God's claim, and the fact that that claim was really upon the tithe itself and not upon its cash value, redemption could only be effected by the payment of the actual cash value plus a fifth. Such an arrangement would act as a deterrent on the materially minded, who would tend altogether to overlook the didactic purpose of the tithe laws, and to penalise those who might wish to discriminate against God by exchanging inferior animals for good when the count was made. It was decreed that both animals would then be forfeit, and the right to redeem revoked. If he change it at all, then both it and the change thereof shall be holy. It shall not be redeemed. Thus God brought home to the deceitful that he would not be deprived of what was rightfully his, and insisted for those who were reluctant to acknowledge it that the tenth is holy unto the Lord. Once again, the part typified the whole. The fact that this sample portion of his material wealth was to be automatically surrendered to God as holy taught the Israelite to consider it his duty to dedicate the whole of his spiritual resources as likewise holy to the Lord. Nothing was to be withheld. Every third year, without fail, was to be an occasion for reminding him of his duty. At the end of 3 years, thou shalt bring forth all the tithe of thine increase the same year, and shalt lay it up within thy gates. And the Levite, because he hath no part nor inheritance with thee, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow which are within thy gates, shall come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all the work of thine hand which thou doest. The nation's attitude to the Levite, and so by natural association of thought, to all others in the same defenceless and precarious position, would thus reveal what was its attitude to God himself. Hence the law: take heed to thyself that thou forsake not the Levite as long as thou livest upon the earth. The Levite's relation to the tithes as a heave offering made it plain that they, like the priests, had a dual role and often acted in the symbolism of the law as types of God as well as of the people. They were the priests, the Levites, as the law repeatedly called them, and as such frequently acted as his representatives in Israel in the discharge of duties which, though they were properly the responsibility of the high priest, were too numerous and too extensive for him to be able to attend to them all. They were the custodians of the written law and the spiritual instructors of the people. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. The Levites were thus much more than an objective representation of Israel. It is in the light of that fact that the full moral significance emerges of God's words to Moses: command the children of Israel that they give unto the Levites of the inheritance of their possessions cities to dwell in. These cities, numbering 48 in all, had to be distributed all over the land and contributed by the various tribes according to the principle of proportional representation. From them that have many ye shall give many, but from them that have few ye shall give few. Every one shall give of his cities unto the Levites according to his inheritance which he inheriteth. The didactic purpose of this arrangement was obvious. The command to Israel to give place among them for the Levites to dwell was but a restatement of the principle embodied in the tabernacle: let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. It was merely a case of adapting that principle to suit fresh circumstances, the moral lesson remaining the same, namely that Israel as a whole was meant to constitute itself a fit abode for God. Each tribe was to play its part according to its resources. This meant that each individual was likewise to further the great moral purpose implicit in Israel's calling to the limit of his gifts and powers. As the teachers of the people, the Levites were to urge each and all to cooperate in a great endeavor to provide a spiritual habitation for God, and insofar as their own revenues depended largely on the spirituality of the people as a whole, they had every inducement to do their duty faithfully. They had to see that all the cities in their locality became like their own, holy to the Lord. Only if they in fact became so could the nation fulfill the symbolism of the light stand by witnessing for God as his priestly people to the nations around, as the priests, the Levites, themselves did to their fellow Israelites. The preeminent Levitical cities were the cities of refuge. There were six of these, three on either side Jordan, each strategically placed so as to be easily accessible from any part of the particular natural division of the land in which it was located. Provision was made for their number to be increased, if need be, to nine. That's in Deuteronomy 19. Again, to ensure that access to them should always be swift and easy, and as an added precaution, it was also decreed that special roads should be built to converge on them. The reason for these special regulations and the care required in observing them lay in the fact that these cities were intended to serve as asylums for any who were guilty of accidental homicide. The sixth commandment categorically outlawed murder. The Book of the Covenant, in keeping with its purpose, next prescribed the penalty for it. He that smiteth a man so that he die shall surely be put to death. This law, being at once so drastic and so general in character, naturally required qualification, which it in fact received. The fatal blow might easily be unintentional and purely accidental. This was duly taken into account, and provision was made for the exemption of the accidental killer from forfeiting his own life in requital for his offence. This was done in such a way that his offence was in no way minimised because it happened to be unintentional. Its gravity was rather emphasised. This was done by making his escape from death contingent upon is taking asylum in a city of refuge. If a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. The eventual provision of the six cities was the application of this earlier law. The law, in making these special arrangements, had to take account of the fact that the right of asylum might be abused by a wanton slayer. Toleration of such an abuse was therefore strictly forbidden, but if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbour to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. Yet death was never to be inflicted until guilt had first been proved by scrupulously careful and just trial. Though once guilt had been proved, it had forthwith to be inflicted by the avenger of blood. The latter would appear, if we take the usage of the Hebrew as a guide, to have been normally the next of kin to the deceased. yet that he acted strictly in an official capacity and was authorized to serve as a public executioner only by special appointment seems equally certain. Otherwise, many a wrongfully accused man would himself be murdered before he could say a word in his own defense. And the purpose of the murder laws, far from being furthered, would be stultified. In the judgment of the law, killing was so serious a crime that capital punishment was prescribed, even in cases where a farmer's criminal negligence resulted in the goring of a man to death by his bull. In this particular case, it did, however, recognize the difference between negligence and malice. To the extent of permitting the commutation of the death penalty to a fine in the case of the former. In the case of malicious killing, on the other hand, no commutation was tolerated. You shall take no satisfaction for the life of a murderer which is guilty of death, but he shall be surely put to death. Commutation to a fine was likewise forbidden in the case of the unintentional killer. The reason for this lay in the fact that his own hand had been responsible for another's death. For him, escape from death by seeking asylum in a city of refuge was all that was allowed. You shall flee unto one of those cities and live. There the fugitive killer had to stay. If he strayed beyond 1,000 cubits of its walls, he exposed himself to arrest by the avenger of blood and inevitable death in consequence. Not until the death of the existing high priest could he recover the right to proceed beyond that limit and return with impunity to his own home. These regulations covered every aspect of homicide and made its enormity plain for all to see. Israel had to observe them most strictly. So shall ye not pollute the land wherein ye are. For blood it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. Defile not therefore the land which ye shall inhabit, wherein I dwell, for I the Lord dwell among the children of Israel. Blood, we see, was as abhorrent to God who dwelt in the land as corruption in the camp in which he walked. The parallel is too exact to be without significance. We know that in the case of the camp, corruption was a symbol of sin. So we can safely conclude the same to have been true of shed blood in the case of the land. It is not difficult to find the reason why it came to have this symbolic value. Sin, as the story of Eden proved conclusively, is a killer, visiting death on those in its power. A murderer, therefore, merely hastened sin's inexorable work in man and brought his victim all the quicker into the clutches of the dread enemy, death. In killing another, he ranged himself on sin's side and acted as sin's agent. In the judgment of the law, he did this so effectively as actually to become a personification of sin and was treated as such in its symbolism. When caught, he had to appear before the congregation in judgment This arrangement allowed his condemnation to be as representative of the entire nation as was practicable in the circumstances. Like the Sabbath breaker in the wilderness, he was in effect put to death by all the congregation when the revenger of blood carried out its sentence. He was, moreover, put to death for the same reason. He had despised the word of the Lord, and had therefore to be utterly cut off. The representative disowning of his crime by the whole congregation was, in fact, essential to the allegory. It enabled his execution to serve as a ritual repudiation by the entire nation of sin, as embodied in and symbolized by the murderer. He had come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile. Like the Sabbath breaker, he was thus a perfect type of the wanton sinner. In the light of that fact, his doom, "ye shall be surely put to death," was a stern and salutary warning to all in Israel to eschew evil and flee from wrongdoing. Yet, what had the law to say in the allegory of the murder laws to those who were sinners despite themselves? It intended such to see themselves typified by the unintentional slayer of his brother. The provision of a city of refuge thus became full of meaning. It signified that God had compassion on the weak and erring in Israel and made provision for their needs. Yet, in assuring them of his mercy, it contrived at the same time to uphold his holiness. It was insistent that the fugitive was not to stray beyond the limits of the city upon risk of death. For his sin, though it had been unintentional, was still sin. And unless he respected the restrictions on his liberty implicit in asylum within the city, he was in effect presuming upon God's mercy and flouting his hatred of sin. Such an attitude was incompatible with acceptable worship, and the law would have men know it. Hence the rule that if the avenger of blood found him without the borders of his city of refuge, killed him, he was to be regarded as solely responsible for his own doom, because he should have remained in the city of his refuge until the death of the high priest. The law thus spoke of pardon for sin, but without abating one jot God's abhorrence of it. Mere lapse of time did not suffice to restore to the fugitive his liberty. Not until the death of the high priest could the slayer return to the land of his possession. How the pious in Israel must have pondered the meaning of that strange arrangement. A man deserving of death granted amnesty upon the death of another, and he, the high priest. What could be signified by this mystery? We can be sure that none could or did resolve the enigma without first understanding the real meaning of both the high priesthood and sacrifices. To be consistent, the law had to legislate for something additional to the city of refuge. Its terms were uncompromising. Blood, it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. A grievous complication arose when, with all the good intention in the world, the authorities sought to bring the miscreant to book, but could not identify or trace him because the crime had been unobserved. The rule still held good. Blood, it defileth the land. Unhappily, it could not be cleansed on this occasion by the blood of him that shed it. To allow for this and to enable the nation to disown the crime and thereby fulfill the allegorical purpose of the murder laws, a special ritual was devised. For simplicity, and justifiably in most cases, the murderer was presumed to be someone from the nearest city. This was represented by its elders. Well, they in turn stood not only for the city but also for the nation as a whole on the familiar principle of representation which we find so often in operation in the law. The elders had to take an heifer which hath not been wrought with and which hath not drawn the yoke. They were then to bring the heifer to an unfrequented and uncultivated dell through which ran a brook, and there break its neck in the presence of the priests, the sons of Levi. The latter doubtless came from the nearest Levitical city, and in the ritual clearly symbolized God as a witness to the transactions. And all the elders of that city that are next unto the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley, and they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen it. Be merciful, O Lord, unto thy people Israel, whom thou hast redeemed. And lay not innocent blood unto thy people of Israel's charge. And the blood shall be forgiven them. The Revised Version makes it clear that the heifer was in no sense a sacrifice. Its blood was not drawn off or manipulated in any way. It was killed by the simple breaking of its neck. There's a footnote here that the unredeemed firstling ass had likewise to be killed in this special non-sacrificial way. It was killed by the simple breaking of its neck. What then was its function? We can at once conclude that it did not symbolize the murderer from the fact that it had to be a virgin animal and unused to the yoke. That is a perfect symbol of purity and innocence. It must therefore have stood for the victim. The latter had not been sinless in the absolute sense, so there was no insistence that the heifer should be without blemish, as in the case of an atoning sacrifice, yet his untimely death had been unjust and undeserved. And to allow for his innocence in this respect, the animal prescribed to typify him had to be a virgin cow. If the heifer represented the victim, its death must have represented his murder. Every aspect of the ceremonial confirms the accuracy of this view. The crime had been unobserved, and for that reason the criminal had been able to flee unnoticed and escape his just deserts. In keeping with that fact, the deserted spot had to be chosen as the site for the special ceremony prescribed in such cases. Thus the heifer was to be suddenly struck down as the victim himself had been, and there as it lay there dead, the elders had to protest their innocence on behalf of the city and nation as a whole. This they did ritually by washing their hands over the carcass in water from the brook, and orally by disowning all responsibility for the crime. With the Levites, that is God, as witness. The Levites, hearing the elders appeal to God for the merciful pardon of the nation whom he had redeemed, doubtless concluded the ceremony by declaring the sin forgiven, so far as the innocent were concerned, and pronouncing the blessing which they were qualified, as types of God, to give in the name of the Lord. The stream was perhaps regarded as symbolically bearing the nation's guilt away in its purifying waters. The murder laws thus had a transparently didactic purpose. They most effectively taught how defiling and dangerous was the presence of sin and of sinners in the midst of the nation. Their lesson did not stop short at the execution of literal murderers, but was infinitely wider in its scope. In all things, in fact, they were to heed God's warning. Defile not, therefore, the land which ye shall inhabit, wherein I dwell. For I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel.